Hey y'all, I'm Whitney Scarborough, the host of Wits End. Here we are real people asking hard questions. If you think you hear the hum of a fridge or a train in the background, it's because you probably are. We are recording these episodes from the comfort of my home in a small town called LaGrange, Texas.
Today I am joined by my wise and dear old friend, Lisa Miser. She shares through tears about her own story of experiencing painful loss, persevering in seasons of grief, and learning to receive both the goodness of God while wrestling with the real hurt. Let's dive in. Friend, it is so good to have you here today. I think we've been talking about doing this now for a couple of years, honestly.
Yeah. Long time.
A long time. So thank you so much for being willing to be on the podcast today. And it's just a privilege to have you here today, Lisa.
Well, it's an honor to be asked, Whit. This is so fun to reconnect after a long time of being apart.
I know. It's so true. So to give our audience a backstory, we met, I think, 15 or so years ago in La Paz, Bolivia. And for those of you who don't know where Bolivia is, it is in South America, and it's a beautiful country that I had the privilege of getting to live in for just a short time. And so that's where we met. That was, I want to say it was about 15 years ago, which is like a lifetime ago. Because I was not married, I didn't have kids, and you were newlywed.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Oh, so, lots of stuff has happened in that time.
So much life has happened, you know? Yes. So I moved away about 2 years after we met, but you and your family continued to live there for quite a long time. So would you just give us some backstory about going to Bolivia as a single person, meeting your husband, having children internationally?
So I felt as early as high school that the Lord had a call on my life for foreign missions, long-term overseas missions. And so I started seeking out what that might look like after I graduated from college. And I was able to find an organization that works around the world, but they had a specific need in Cochabamba, Bolivia. So I said, okay, I'm going to go, which was huge for me because I had never left home before. I stayed in my hometown for college and even lived with my parents for part of that time. So it was a big deal for me to get on a plane by myself as a young single woman. I was 23 and go to this country that I had barely even heard of before. But I was excited and I knew that the call was very firm, you know, so I didn't question that part of it. So I began working with youth in Cochabamba, and it was hard, but I fell in love with the country, the people, the food, the culture, the language, everything. Mm-hmm. Like, I just loved it, and I knew I wanted to be there, like, for as long as God would let me be there.
Indefinitely. And
then, I didn't know, obviously, what that looked like, but I was in. So I met Scotty, who is my husband, just about 6 months into my time in Cochabamba. And he was also new to the mission world. He was just starting out his service there. And we became good friends. We had friends in common. You know, we were spending more and more time together. And it was pretty quick that we had an interest for something more, you know, to see if something else could come out of this friendship. And I was technically not allowed to date for like the whole first term. I had signed on for a 3-year term.
Okay.
He was not supposed to date either, but I think we both talked to our bosses and kind of laid out the situation, and we were given the green light to, you know, just kind of pursue what this could look like.
Yeah.
Which was great. So like fast forward a year and a half and we're engaged and married.
Wow. So,
yeah, it was amazing. It was interesting because early on in our time together, getting to know each other, a mutual friend asked both of us, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And we both answered Bolivia. And it was kind of one of those like, oh, okay, we're kind of on the same page here with what the Lord is doing you know, for our lives long term.
Yeah. Which when you're, I think, at a young place, younger place, you know, pre-children, pre-marriage, to mm-hmm. think about, okay, I'm going to be here for 5 years, just to say that right off the bat, that says something, because at that time, yeah. I think 5 years sounds kind of like a long time. You know,
for sure.
Oh, that's a big commitment to make, you know?
For sure. Yeah. And I think it didn't feel that way at first when I went, you know, by myself as a single person, because it was a 3-year commitment. And I thought, okay, this is,
right.
I'm still like in my own mind, like marrying age. Of course, there's no limits right. on that age, but kind of in what I had hoped would happen in life. But I wasn't expecting to meet a guy either overseas,
right.
you know?
Right.
So it was just one of those like bonuses that the yeah. Lord threw in there.
Fun surprise. Yeah.
Fun surprise. So we got married here in the States, and the plan was to spend a year in the U.S. kind of getting used to marriage. We had been counseled to like maybe do our first year of marriage in our home culture, because there's obviously a fair number of stressors in your first year of marriage. So doing it overseas might have been even more difficult. So
right.
we kind of planted here in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we were able to join a church and kind of make a friendship base as a couple, because we didn't have any common ground here in the States. But the plan was to go back to La Paz, which is the capital, and join a church planting team that was made up of another missionary couple and a bunch of Bolivian families, and they were about to launch the church. So after a year, that's what we did. We went back to La Paz. We rented an apartment in the neighborhood where we were going to start the church, and also where the school where you were working with.
Yeah, how we met. Right.
Where we met. It was all there. So we were like super focused on this one community, getting to know our neighbors, getting to know the teachers at the school, and just kind of, you know, starting the adventure of a new church. It was something neither of us had done. It was super exciting. So before long, we also started a family. We had our first daughter, Natalie. She's almost 13. She's turning 13 next month.
Which is sweet, because I do remember that. I got to be there for that, which was so sweet.
Yes, I remember. We still have this beautiful painting that you made for her for our baby shower. That was a special thing that was hanging in their room in Bolivia. And then we had Jubilee, who is 9. And then we adopted Moses from La Paz, and he is 6. So all of the big moments of our lives as a married couple have been in La Paz. And it's been so fun just to be able to give our kids the gift of living overseas. I mean, for them, that's home, even though their passport country is the U.S., all but Moses. They call Bolivia home. And giving them the opportunity to just have a wider perspective on the world, you know, is something that we always wanted to be able to give our kids. So it was just so much fun for our family to, like, experience the wildness of Bolivia and the warmth of the people and the culture. And we love it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you and I have talked about this, and we want to just dive in the deep end today with the time that we have. But you shared with me recently that while there have been great victories and beautiful seasons, you look back and you see a theme of loss over the course of your life. Mm-hmm. And you didn't say this in a really woe is me kind of way. But I would love for you just to take us back to share and walk through some of those losses. Because, you know, what you just shared was a lot of the beautiful moments and some of the more, you know, the highs and the, the things that show up on the Christmas card, you know? So I'd
get
love
in the newsletter.
Yes, exactly. So would you just take us through some of those losses?
Yeah. Well, definitely I would say the one that stands out the most to me is the loss of our son, Zion. So after Natalie was born, I had a normal pregnancy with her, and then I got pregnant again with a little boy. And for some inexplicable reason, I went into labor at like 28 weeks. We tried really hard to stop the labor, but he was born at 30 weeks. For those of you who don't know La Paz, it's at like 12,000 feet above sea level. So the lack of oxygen was definitely a factor, I think, that made it so difficult for him to thrive there and grow. He struggled and was in the NICU for about 3 weeks. So I was going, you know, every day driving up in downtown. It was pretty far from where we lived. And visiting him and praying and, you know, just asking God, what do I do, you know? And the medical system in Bolivia is kind of substandard. It's not, you know, it's not a great system. So yeah. I feel like he did not have the same opportunity that he might have, you know, if we had had him in the U.S. The cool thing was that there was a friend of mine who knew the head pediatric doctor at a big children's hospital in the States, and he also was fluent in Spanish. So my doctor in Bolivia was communicating wow. every single day with this doctor, like, what can we do? How can we help this baby? What have I not thought of yet? You know?
Right.
So it was cool how that played out. Mm. However, about 3 weeks after Zion was born, he died. We were able to be with him. The nurses had not let us pick him up at all until the day that he died. And so they gave us a call early one morning and said, all of his organs are failing, you better come. And so we came to the hospital and we held him while he died. Sorry. So that was, it was almost 11 years ago, but it's still, there's those moments, yeah. you know, where it just hits, which is grief, right? Like it kind of hits yeah. out of the blue when you're not expecting it. So obviously that was devastating, you know, for us as a family. Natalie was a toddler at that point, so she wasn't completely aware of what was going on, but she definitely sensed, you know, my sadness, Scotty's sadness. It was very apparent. And for me, it was interesting because even though I might not have vocalized this out loud, I kind of always had this idea that people fell into two camps, like people who had experienced a deep loss or suffering of some kind and those who hadn't. And I, up until that point, was in the camp of like, the blessed life, you know, like I hadn't really gone through any major traumas or losses. And I kind of thought that I wouldn't, you know, until I was way older, you know, like old.
Right.
So it was really a paradigm shift for me, especially in my faith, like, God, how can this happen to me? This was something that happened to other people. Right. Like, what do I do with this? And I remember even in the days right after Zion was born and I was still in the hospital, a friend of mine, a well-meaning friend, you know, came in and she said, don't worry, you know, you are doing the Lord's work. He will not let your baby die. And I just remember even at that moment, as much as I wanted to believe her, thinking, I don't think God works that way. You know, like,
wow,
ultimately Zion's life is in his hands. And if he doesn't choose to heal my son, then he has every right to do what he wants to do, and he doesn't owe me anything, you know? So obviously for a while I was just terribly sad, depressed. I never thought I'd be happy again. And I found also kind of a lack of space to grieve that in the Bolivian culture. I think Bolivians live with a certain amount of tragedy constantly, you know, it's a hard place. There's a lot of poverty. So I think people are used to experiencing things like that, but there's also a level of kind of shoving it down. There was a neighbor one time who said his father had died, but he chooses never to think about that, you know, and we kind of saw that that was a common theme, like when talking about loss or even serious illness. Sometimes people would keep serious illness from their family members. Like they wouldn't tell someone that they had cancer because they thought it was just too much for that person to handle. So once a friend of my Bolivian friend called for something unrelated to Zion, and she just offhandedly said, hey, how you doing? And it was probably 2 weeks after Zion had passed away. And I said, you know what? I'm really struggling. Like, I am so sad. And she kind of gasped and said, what's wrong? You know? And I said, well, my son died a couple weeks ago, you know? And she was just kind of like, oh, you're still thinking about that? Like, okay. And so it was just this interesting introduction into maybe how people just don't process grief there, you know? And it really stuck with me. So So fast forward a few years, we had our second daughter, Jubilee, after that. And then we started the adoption process, which was crazy, but totally worth it. And we got our little boy, Moses. He was 7 months when he came home. And I had read, you know, all the literature and all the stuff about some of the challenges that kids from hard places experience. But I thought, oh no, like our son's not going to deal with that stuff.
Wow.
I think I just didn't know how I would deal with it if that was his story, but it was, you know, it's kind of inevitable. So we started dealing with some of the hard things, you know, that as an infant came out kind of in just screaming all night long for like a year. That was kind of how it started.
Wow.
As a toddler, it was just these raging meltdowns that I couldn't do anything about. I felt completely helpless. I didn't know how to handle it. It was exhausting. You know, it changed the dynamic of our family and what we could or couldn't do. We started having to really shift how we thought about our day. You know, can we do that event or is that going to be too overwhelming for Moses? You know, could we stay up a little bit later or is that going to like cause him to lose it? You know? So we were finding that we were having to pull back from a lot of the activities that we were used to doing. And we were also noticing that the girls were suffering because we were stressed. You know, we were stressed out. We were just tired of kind of the drama, you know, and it sounds terrible. And we were committed to trying to figure out how to best help our son process all of his own traumatic issues, you know, but it's a long journey, you know, it's a real long journey and we're still
absolutely
on it. But it was a type of loss, you know, different from Zion. It was kind of a loss of just normalcy, you know, what I considered normal or like what we felt like we could do as a family. Like that was no longer happening in the same way.
I'm just thinking about how you have probably these unexpected losses in the sense of, wow, this is some, you know, this is a little person who we love unconditionally and we have brought into our family. And yet it could change things for good, you know, like forever. It could change the dynamic of our family and almost probably not, you know, not even knowing what that was going to look like. Mm-hmm. You know, and not wanting to hold that against him, but at the same time being there's this grief for this little child that you're getting to know in a different way than you developed a relationship with your other children. And you're also grieving the loss that, you know, that they've obviously had great trauma that has affected them in a way that you know, was before you were a part of their life. I mean, it's just so many layers.
Yes. Yeah, we definitely saw kind of that secondary trauma that happens when you're spending time, when you're caring for someone who has their own, you know, issues. It starts to affect those who are closest to them, you know. So we were seeing that in ourselves. We were seeing it with our kids. And again, we were kind of in this environment where people didn't understand that. You know, there's not an adoptive culture in Bolivia. So we'd get comments like, oh, but, you know, when he was abandoned, he doesn't remember that. Like, that's in the past. Like, he doesn't know what happened. So, like, why is this such a big deal? And we were kind of felt like there were some judgmental thoughts about that. And we understand that it's just kind of a lack of knowledge, you know, about what all of that looks like. But we didn't really have a community that an adoptive community where we could relate to other parents who had also adopted. We did have people who wanted to support us and walk with us through the process. And we had some friends that were really just important to us in that. But none of them had adopted children. So yeah, that was another one of those just tough things. And then the most recent just loss was leaving Bolivia. You know, that one is, we're still kind of in the thick of it. Our dream was to raise our kids, you know, until they graduated from high school. We had built a house there. Obviously, we buried a child there. I mean, we buried Zion in our backyard, like his ashes, you know. So here we've left the ashes of our son there in La Paz. Our process of leaving was a surprise to us when we found out it was going to happen. When the Lord was closing the door there, it became apparent very quickly, but it wasn't something that we foresaw. So there was a lot of grief in it happening kind of without us giving permission for it to happen. You know, it wasn't our choice. And there's, you know, a whole backstory there that's not necessary to go into, but
right.
It was just a shock. And we had about 5 months to, you know, pack up all of our stuff, whatever could fit in 10 suitcases, you know, figuring out what is the most important thing. Selling everything else or giving it away, saying goodbye to these friends who had walked with us through all of the hard and all of the good things, saying goodbye to our church that we had loved and like started from the very beginning with and had seen grown to this amazing, beautiful congregation with Bolivians just growing in their faith and learning to serve and to teach and and then the school, Scotty had actually switched over to the school where you were teaching about 6 years ago and had been teaching there for the last, you know, 6 years before we left. So saying goodbye to that school where we thought, you know, our kids are going to grow up in this school.
Wow.
And then selling our house, which was like our dream home. It was such a precious place for us. I thanked God every single day for that house because we just... we're so happy there. We still have not sold it, but it, there were so many things to say goodbye to. Our pets, we had to like find homes for our dogs. It was a lot. It was a lot. And, you know, there was a confidence in knowing that the Lord was moving in all of it, but it didn't make it easier, you know, to actually say the goodbyes and to know that it could be years before we see some of those people again. We might never see some of them the side of eternity, you know? We don't know. So that was just kind of a loss of a dream and a loss of an expectation and a hope and our community, you know, that we've walked with for 15 years. So that was huge.
Absolutely. And it's still really fresh. I mean, you're sharing a lot of things that, you know, some that happened many years ago and some that you're still walking through the heaviness and the day-to-day grief of some of those losses. And, you know, as you were talking, I was just thinking about even, and you didn't share this, but I remember actually walking through a miscarriage with you, before Natalie was born.
Yeah.
And I remember just so vividly, just watching you guys walk faithfully with God through that. And it's been such a privilege to see you guys walk faithfully with God over these years. And granted, it's been from a distance, but it's still been very vivid. In the times we do get to connect or just in your email updates, just to see that you guys are clinging to the Lord. And I would just love for you to share with us some of the ways that God has drawn you close in those times and how you've wrestled with him and what are some of the truths that he's etched on your hearts through obviously what have been some really hard and painful lows.
Well, I'll tell you, it took some time. I think when you don't experience the suffering, you actually don't really have a practical theology of suffering. You know, you can kind of say and repeat what the Bible says, which is true, but when you go through it, it's like, oh, do I really believe this? You know, do I really believe that in God's sovereignty, he is still good when he allows these things to happen in my life? And that was a huge question for me after we lost Zion. And in the miscarriage, was, gosh, Lord, this doesn't feel good. How can taking a child out of the world be a good thing? You know?
Right.
And I can't tell you that I have specific answers to that question, but what I think the Lord does, because, you know, we know that Christ was a man of sorrows acquainted with grief. Like, he knows what it's like to lose and he knows what it's like to suffer. And I think he meets you in a special way when you're broken. You know, God is near to the brokenhearted. And so I think through my tears and my questions and my, you know, my angst, there was just always this presence of the Lord, you know, with this gentleness and this love, kind of just reminding me that he's there and that he loves me and that I might not understand, but I can trust him. And it, it took a while for me to get to that place where I could say, I still don't have answers to this. I don't know why this happened, but I do know God is good. I know that he's good. You know, he is my good father. And there were little things that he did along the way in that process. Like, well, this was a big thing. He gave me a friend shortly after Zion died who had also lost a son a few years before we lost Zion. And she lived in our neighborhood. She went to our church and she used to walk. We would walk around the neighborhood together almost every day. She would just call and say, hey, I'm going for a walk. Do you want to come? And I would just put on my tennis shoes and I would go outside and we would walk and I would cry and I would vent and rage, and she would just listen and she would cry with me, and she was just there. She was a presence, you know, and I feel like that was almost like the hands and feet of Jesus, you know.
Absolutely.
I couldn't feel him some days, you know. You know these things in your mind to be true, but you just want to feel something, and I feel like that was him saying, I'm here, here's your friend, this is me, you know, like I am walking with you. And so that was a beautiful relationship, you know, that helped me just process through that. I think one thing that the suffering and the hard things did for me as well was just give me an ability to connect with people in their suffering. You know, again, before having gone through those things myself, I didn't really know how to deal with really hard stories. You know, people would share and I would just think, gosh, that's terrible. And then I'd kind of like put a wall up because I didn't know what to do with that.
Right.
So having gone through my own pain gave me this desire and ability to empathize with other women who either had gone through similar experiences or dissimilar, but also just painful, you know, and to walk with them in that and hear them and be a friend, you know, to them and to give them space. I think one thing the Lord impressed on me was just the need for Bolivian women to be given the freedom to express their grief and to not suppress it. So that kind of became, I felt like a personal ministry for me, you know, was to reach out to these women who were suffering and nobody had ever told them it's okay to cry, you know, and in fact, probably told them it's not okay.
Wow.
So that was just a sweet ministry that I had never had before. And in fact, I feel for many years that I really struggled as a missionary, feeling like I was just no good at it, you know? And I think if the Lord had not allowed me to experience certain hardships, I probably would have continued to walk very superficially with people. So that was a beautiful gift that the Lord gave me, a redemption, you know, of what I experienced was being able to connect with women on that level.
Wow. That's so powerful. I think just hearing you even talk about that, I think just gave me a whole new perspective of even what it means to be made more like Christ in suffering, because I think you just hit it on the, you know, the nail on the head of just saying how, you know, Christ was acquainted with grief and that we know that he is, you know, the Bible is clear that he is a high priest that can identify with us in our sufferings and meet us in our sufferings, you know, and, and that Jesus characteristic is something that he's cultivated in you and in Scotty in a way that allowed you to meet deeply with people in those hard places. And so even in your ability to connect, you know, not just saying, oh, I have a similar experience, but your understanding of even how to reach and meet and connect and love someone in that is so huge, you know? So you guys are back in the States now and you're starting over in a sense. And you're just on the front end of beginning to put down some roots for the first time in a new place as a family, and really your first time as a family to live in the States. So I know you guys in this season, there's still losses. And like we said earlier, this is still, some of the hurt is still fresh. What are some things that you guys are currently practicing, learning, reading, or listening to?
Well, when we were getting ready to leave Bolivia, we decided we were going to try to the best of our ability to process well the transition. So we did all the things, you know, we cried with people, we blessed people with our words, we spent time with people, the goodbye parties, you know, we just really went there and we cried a whole lot, you know, and then we were also trying to sell all of our stuff. So when we got here, we were pretty exhausted, and I'm an introvert, so I was hardcore ready for like some quiet family / me time. So the first thing we did was just kind of hunker down, and we put up some pretty strong boundaries. We don't have a lot of relationships here. My parents do live here, so we did spend some time with them, but we kind of just said, okay, we're going to take this summer while Scotty's and the kids are not in school, and we're just going to do us stuff. You know, we're going to hang out and we're going to read and we're going to go on adventures. And like you said, it's our first time living here. So it's kind of like, okay, what does the Miser family fun look like in Florida? You know,
right.
How do we do this? And what do we like to do? And we got bicycles and started riding, you know, around the city.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like one of those dreams I've always had for my family that we couldn't do in La Paz because everything is like straight up and straight down there. It's very mountainous, as you know. there's a lot of stray dogs. There's no sidewalks. Like biking is just,
it's kind of out of the question.
Yeah. We didn't do that. so here it was like, yes, it's flat. There's sidewalks. It's amazing. Mm. So we said a lot of yeses to our kids that we might have not normally said to them, like, yes, let's go get ice cream. Yes. Let's watch a movie. Yes, let's go to an amusement park. You know, we took our kids to Knott's Berry Farm in California. We'd never been to an amusement park together, you know, so
it was such an experience. Yeah.
It was pretty hysterical, actually. My kids just didn't even know what to do.
I was overwhelmed a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it was fun, but it was funny to watch them respond to like roller coasters.
And,
so I think that was the first thing that helped. And I just so desperately wanted my kids to experience some joy in the midst of having to say goodbye to their home and their friends and their pets and everything familiar, was just finding some joy, you know, in that process. I think trying to think of other things that we've done. We have actually started doing a Devo book together, or it's a 30-day devotional written by friends of mine.
Oh, cool.
When their family was moving. And so it has 30 days of scriptures that kind of remind you who is God in this moment of transition and turmoil, and then some really practical, simple activities or things to think about that just help you as a family continue to process.
Wow.
So we are high on like, let's do this right the first time. Let's actually process it and go through the grief and the pain and the conversations so that we don't have to like, it doesn't come back to haunt us later, you know,
absolutely.
Because we've just glossed over it.
So brushed it under the, or swept it under, the rug or whatever. Yeah. Swept it under.
Yeah. So that's, you know, we want to give our kids a language for grief and for sadness. And it's okay to talk about these things and feel them. And it's part of the whole beautiful picture, you know? So we've been doing that every day with the kids. And I think, you know, sometimes it's hard for us to like go there and have to process those feelings. And it's maybe even harder sometimes for children who don't always have words for the things that they're feeling. But that's been a really helpful thing just to kind of have a little script, you know, of what are some questions? What are some things we can be thinking about? And what does God have to say about this whole process? You know, who is he in the midst of that? So those are a couple of things that have been helpful as we are still kind of in the midst of the journey.
Yeah, that's awesome. I would have loved to see those snapshots they take on the roller coasters of the your kids on their first roller coaster.
Well, Jubilee,
that's so fun.
She was so excited to go, and the first ride we took her on, she screamed the entire time, "This is not fun. I hate it."
Oh, bless her heart.
So yeah, it was pretty funny and sad, but
it's sad.
Moses had a blast. He was like, put me on the biggest roller coaster. I'm ready. He wanted to ride everything.
How funny. That's so awesome. Oh, yeah. I love it. I love it. Well, I want to ask you a couple more serious questions, and then I promise I won't make you do this too much longer, because I know this is hard, and I just am so grateful for you for being so willing to share vulnerably. And you know, I know that we have prayed about this together even before this podcast, but just praying for whoever is listening, that wherever you are, that God would meet you and encourage you through this conversation. And so I want to ask you just the question. And again, there, I know there's no clean, cut and dry, you know, set perfect answer for this. But really for you and Scotty, how do you reconcile the painful losses that you guys have experienced with the truth that you've clung to of knowing a good God?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think what I mentioned earlier about just walking through the process and experiencing God's faithfulness in community and in His Word and in the hope, it's not something that you can say it was this particular thing that convinced me of God's goodness, but it was just His presence in all of it, and the way that he gives, you know, faith to believe is a gift from God, you know. So I think also the ability to say, yes, Lord, this situation was awful and I wish it never happened, but I still trust you. And, you know, we've learned some language for this paradox, which there's a little activity that we did in a debrief called the pair of ducks, you know, and you take these two little rubber ducks and one is the yay duck and one is the yuck duck. And it's kind of this idea that the scriptures and our lives are filled with paradoxes, you know, the pair of ducks where it can be yay and it can be yuck at the same time. You know, we can have this awful situation and yet there's also the goodness of God that somehow infuses everything that's happening. And so I think learning to be okay with the paradox of suffering and God's goodness going somehow together. You know, it's this mystery that we don't understand and we don't have words for, but we can say, I see it everywhere. You know, I see, you know, Job said, how are we going to receive blessing from the hand of God, but not suffering? You know, this is how God works in His kingdom. And He's got the overarching picture of that, where it all works so beautifully together. We have such a limited view, you know, in our perspective of how that's all playing into this intricately woven, you know, tapestry of God's kingdom and what he's up to, and in each of our individual lives. And so somehow, as we walked through these hard times, it was the both and situation, you know? And so I don't have a better way to explain it other than just the grace of God enabling us to continue to trust what we know to be true about Him and remembering His faithfulness at other points, you know, just how He has so consistently walked with us, provided for us, guided us, loved us, surrounded us with other believers. You know, I think a community is so, so, so important when you're going through hard things. So yeah, that's kind of where we landed.
Yeah. How would you encourage a woman or a man, anybody listening really, to persevere, who maybe is currently weighed down with grief and just feels like they can't imagine even getting past it?
Yeah. I think giving yourself a lot of grace, you know, I feel like we are so quick to be hard on ourselves when we're in the midst of a really hard situation, especially as believers. We think, why is this such a big deal for me? Why can't I just get through this? I should trust God. I should believe these things. And the reality is that there's a lot going on, not just spiritually, but even neurologically, you know, in the middle of suffering, where your brain's doing a lot of stuff, your emotions are doing a lot of stuff, and it takes time. You know, it's messy. Like we talked about earlier, it's not linear. You know, grief is kind of like a big tangled mass of yarn. Mm-hmm. Like you just find yourself doing great one day and just terrible the next day. And when those moments happen, you feel like, oh no, I've taken two steps back. You know, I thought I was doing better. And so I think just grace for the process, that it takes time. The only way through it is to go through it. You know, you have to just experience each day and whatever kind of ups and downs it brings. I would tell myself a lot in those moments where I would just break down crying, which were fairly frequently right before we left Bolivia. I would say, okay, crying is good. Crying is part of processing this grief. I'm doing a good job here, you know? So I would kind of like remind myself this, I'm processing as I cry. This is a way of acknowledging this is hard. This is like the result of a broken world. It's not the way it should be, but it is what we have to experience. And by the grace of God, we'll get there. I think also finding someone that you trust that you can share with. There is a purpose for the community of God, you know, the family of God. He made us to be in communion with one another. And so I think, like, I had my friend that I walked with after Zion died, having somebody that you can just put it all out there with. They're not going to judge you. You're not worried about what they're thinking. You can just be real and share all the yucky stuff and walk with them, and they can hear you and validate your feelings. I think that's so key.
Yeah.
And there's even neurologically, I'm totally into like brain science. There's something that happens in your brain when you are able to tell your story out loud or to write it.
Wow.
That helps your brain kind of move forward and make like healthy connections. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, so I can't totally describe it perfectly, but it's this beautiful thing that I think totally flows with what we know from scripture, you know, that we are meant to carry each other's burdens. And so not being afraid to go there and say, I'm really struggling, because I think that's another place sometimes in the church that we don't give the freedom for people to say, I'm struggling, like hardcore struggling, you know?
Absolutely.
So that's important too.
Wow. Friend, this has been so good. And there's so much more that I could ask you. I feel like you're like a deep well of wisdom, and truly, it's so true. So thank you so much, friend, for being here and for doing just that, what you just said, of just sharing your story. And I do pray, and I know you hope and desire the same thing, that this would be a blessing and an encouragement, and just that the Lord would speak to whoever is listening today. So,
thank you. It's been my honor.
It's so great.
We'll be back in just a minute after a word from our sponsor.
Welcome to another episode of Questionable Questions. I'm your host, Tim Scarborough, and this is your co-host,
Whitney. Hello.
We are just sitting here in a quiet house. All of our kids have gone to bed. We're drinking a little Cabernet Sauvignon.
What shelf did you buy this on?
It was the middle shelf. So not the $2 Chuck. But not the $30 bottle.
Oh, babe.
It was like the
$5 to $10
bottle.
Stepping it up a little bit.
Yeah, so if you hear some gulps happening, that's what that is. Okay, so my first question of this week is, what is your biggest pet peeve?
I think I've told a lot of people this, because it is like, this is a big deal. Okay, I have to give a little backstory though. I remember one time we were at this restaurant that I thought was like the nicest restaurant ever. I think it was like the Olive Garden.
Wait, what period of life was this for you?
We were like, I was like 11 or something.
Okay, and that makes more sense.
Yeah. And I remember being like, But it wasn't Olive Garden. It was called Charlie's. I think, isn't that a chain? Oh, Charlie's?
Yeah. But yeah, it's not, that was it's it. Not Italian. It's very Irish.
Yeah, you're right. So we're at this restaurant, and I remember sitting there in these green leather booths and being like, oh, it's my favorite restaurant. I would always ask to go to O'Charlie's for my birthday. Seriously? Because they had these big like yeast butter rolls, and they were like so delicious, and they were free, you know, you could just, it's like chips and salsa at a Mexican restaurant,
like
just
unlimited breadsticks at Olive Garden.
Unlimited, you know, they just keep bringing them out, they're so good. And so I remember we're at O'Charlie's, and my mom got this salad, and she orders her salad, and it comes out. She's like, as she starts to take a bite, she's like, there is a huge hair in my salad, like a long hair in my salad. And I remember being like, Mom, that's not a big deal. Like, just pick it out. And she was like, no, I have to ask him to take it back, and like, I need a new salad. And I was like, what? That is so ridiculous. Like, I don't think I knew the phrase high maintenance, but that's kind of what I was saying. Like, Mom, like, come on, get over it. No big deal. How do you know it's not your hair, you know? And so I remember making fun of her about it. And now, fast forward to now, that is my biggest pet peeve. Hair, like loose hair in general, not even hair in food. That is disgusting. But loose hair, like when I am washing dishes, or I'm like typing an email, or I'm folding laundry, and I feel like phantom hairs, like, and it's like there's like one random hair maybe on the back of my arm, and I can feel it, but I can't get it, and I keep like brushing it off and I can't find it.
Oh, it's terrible.
You basically need to just like take a lint roller and like just like, you know, flail it around me a couple times every day, and I'll be so much happier. And it's only happened in the last like 5 or so years since I've been like losing my hair like a, I don't know, like a molting pony or something. But I was just like losing hair like crazy ever since I had Opie Jack, our third kid. It's like, it's bad. So that is it. No question. On a regular basis.
Stray hairs is your biggest pet peeve.
Yeah, loose hairs. It's disgusting. And I mean, and then if I find one in food, and honestly, so now it's probably mine. When I find it in food, I just assume it's mine because I feel like my hair sheds all the time. Like, I feel like I'm like a golden retriever.
So now your mom's...
I don't even like to wash my hair
because of that. Do you send food back whenever you get hairs in your food now?
You know, I don't think I've had that opportunity yet. But I don't know that I would. But honestly, if I was confident that it was like, I've literally just taken a bite and this is like a hair embedded in the salad, for sure I would probably have to be like, I can't do it. Or I would just be like, not gonna eat it, you know? I mean, I know there are people listening that can agree. That's raunch. But again, it took a while. Like, for a while that didn't bother me. Now, you know, now in my adult years, it's like, that's wrong, you know? There's something wrong about that. Does it bother you?
Stray hairs?
Yeah.
No?
Not really?
Not particularly.
Okay. I mean, you have a beard. Yeah. So, that's another thing, is I find your stray hairs everywhere, your beard hairs.
Nah.
No, for sure. They're very hard to mistake. Red beard hair.
Yeah, if you hate stray hairs, you shouldn't have married a bearded fellow.
When I married you, you did not have a beard. You did not have a beard. So, you know what?
It grew on me.
I think you broke our vows.
It grew on me, and then it grew on you.
It literally grew on you. That's actually true. I don't know that it grew on me, but...
You say it did.
I mean, yeah. I like it.
I didn't give you much of a choice, though.
Yeah, no. It fits your personality, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, question number 2.
Okay.
If you ran for public office, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, I cannot believe you're asking me that. Well, I would never. It's literally like the last
thing. No, I wouldn't say never.
You think, actually, Charlotte, we have a 9.5, almost 10-year-old daughter who's so deep. And tonight she asked me this question as we were sitting at soccer practice. She said, Mom, what is a job that you've always wanted but you've never had?
She asked me the same thing recently.
Really? Where did she come up with love that. I didn't even tell you that. I forgot to tell you. It was so fascinating. I was like, whoa. I was like, that's a great question.
What'd you say, public office?
No, that was not on my radar. I said, honestly, Charlotte, I'm going to probably die and there's going to be like a billion jobs that I'm going to be like, oh, that would have been so cool to do. I've always wanted to be a florist for a little bit. I thought that would be so cool to do. I thought it would just be fun to live in New York. That's not really a job, but I guess
it's not a job.
But I guess, like, I don't know, work in a, you know, have like an office job.
You could be a florist in New York.
Yeah. Nah. But anyways, we're way off track. Okay. What was the question?
You ran for public office.
I'm kidding.
What would the job be? Commissioner?
I don't know what the offices are. I know president. I know senator. I know governor.
I mean, you could go local government, mayor. You could go...
I know.
You know.
Okay, okay.
You could go all the way up to the state level, all the way up to the federal.
It's embarrassing to admit, but I don't really know what all those people do. So...
I mean, it's pretty important stuff.
It's very important stuff.
They
no
run.
No offense, Governor Abbott or President Biden. I know y'all's jobs are very important, but I just don't. I guess I just don't really know very much about like what each of the individual responsibilities are for. You know, Senator versus House of Representatives versus you know, a governor versus.
So you probably wouldn't want to start there.
No. Yeah. No.
You'd probably want to start with local government. Okay, probably. So if you ran for local government.
Yeah, mayor sounds fun.
Mayor?
Yeah, mayor, maybe. Mayor well, of La Grange.
I'm sure most of those people don't know the first thing about running a women's ministry.
True. True. Touche.
Yeah, so you're even.
No, I guess in all seriousness, if I was going to go for a public office, I could see being vice president. I feel like that would be a good role for me.
Okay.
A supporting role. I could be a really good encourager. I just would really, really hope that president did not get shot because I do not want to be president. I have no desire to be the bad guy. You know? I mean, what president?
The president's the bad guy?
Well, I mean, at what point in every single presidency is the president not at some point the bad guy? Like, you cannot tell
Yeah,
me.
You lose favor.
Yeah, I mean, their popularity plummets very quickly, you know? So I think vice president would be a good one if you were like, listen, I'll take this. I'll be a good support. I'll be a very good leading lady of the country.
As long as you don't go dying on
us. Yeah, as long as if the president dies, I don't have to take over. If we just could write that clause into
the Constitution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just for those 4 years, I would say, sure, I'll do that.
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah.
Whitney Scarborough for vice president, 2024.
Hey, we have a woman right now, so.
Yeah.
It's more plausible.
Than ever. She's broken the glass ceiling.
It's true. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, let's see if our listeners can decipher what this is.
Stop it. It sounds like you're peeing right now.
It does kind of sound like I'm peeing into a glass. That is...
What is... Anyways, can anyone guess?
No? No guesses?
Nope.
That's Cabernet Sauvignon through an aerator.
Yeah. The jury's still out on if that aerator really matters.
It makes it taste more fancy.
It makes it sound more fancy.
Yeah, it does.
But then it's kind of frothy. That's weird. That's the thing I don't love about it.
No, it introduces more air into the wine.
Why do we need that? I don't want air in my wine.
It oxidizes it.
I don't know why that matters.
Well, taste it without it, and you'll know.
I can't tell the difference.
Well, you're not as much of a connoisseur as you should be.
Okay.
That's all for this week. Join us next time on Questionable Questions.
To find show notes for this and past episodes, or to engage on a deeper level, you can go to wovenministry.com/podcast. If you enjoy what you hear so far, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps listeners find and share this feed. If you'd like to tell us what you enjoyed about this podcast or ask your hard question, you can call us at 512-815-2446. That's 512-815-2446. You'll simply leave a voicemail with what's on your mind, and we might just include your voice on a future episode. Music and editing for the show is by Callan Brown. Recording and production by Tim Scarborough. I'm Whitney Scarborough, and we'll be back here with more very soon. Thanks for listening.